This is a very loud microphone. The chapter is, my Bible has the subheading, Laws Concerning Warfare. It's guidelines acknowledging that even after the people of God are led into the land that God has set aside for them, and even after they do the initial conquering of the land and taking over of the territory, there will still, from time to time, be wars that they have to fight. So these are guidelines for how to go about fighting Yahweh's way. As we're going through the book of Deuteronomy, it's come up a few times that, you know, at this point, 3,000 years ago in the time of Moses, God's people were a nation. And so they at times had to behave as a nation, which included, you know, literal warfare. Not being a nation anymore, we are not likely to be called to assemble an army on behalf of Jesus. But there are still battles that we are compelled to fight from time to time. Our enemies being not other nations, but as tradition has put it, the world, the flesh, and the devil. The world means institutions and systems that are slanted away from God and towards sin, that invite you into sin, right? The advertising industry. That's the world, right? Flesh is our own personal or communal inclinations towards sin and away from God. And the devil means not just the evil spirit that we call Satan or Lucifer, but all spirits and spiritual realities that are in rebellion against God and working to undermine his goodness in creation. And from time to time, there are battles that we are compelled to fight against these enemies as the people of God. And so this chapter gives us guidelines about how to fight the battles God calls us to, God's way. I'm going to read it in a moment, and then I'm going to just ignore any responsibility to kind of cover the chapter equitably, because in this week, as I've been preparing, one particular aspect of this has come out more and more and seems of particular importance for me and for us as a community. So I'll read the whole chapter. I'll make a couple of brief comments about the other guidelines here, and then we're really going to focus on weakness and fear in fighting battles. So, Deuteronomy chapter 20. When you go out to war against your enemies and see horses and chariots and an army larger than your own, you shall not be afraid of them. For Yahweh your God is with you, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And when you draw near to the battle, the priest shall come forward and speak to the people and shall say to them, "Hear, O Israel, today you are drawing near for battle against your enemies. Let not your heart faint. Do not fear or panic or be in dread of them, for Yahweh your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to give you the victory." Then the officers shall speak to the people, saying, "Is there any man who has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in battle and another man dedicate it. And is there any man who has planted a vineyard and has not enjoyed its fruit? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man enjoy his fruit. And is there any man who has betrothed a wife and has not taken her? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man take her." And the officers shall speak further to the people and say, "Is there any man who is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go back to his house, lest he make the heart of his fellows melt like his own." And when the officers have finished speaking to the people, then the commanders shall be appointed at the head of the people. When you draw near to a city to fight against it, offer terms of peace to it. And if it responds to you peaceably and opens to you, then all the people who are found in it shall do forced labor for you and shall serve you. But if it makes no peace with you, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it. And when Yahweh your God gives it into your hand, you shall put all its males to the sword. But the women and the little ones, the livestock and everything else in the city, all its spoil, you shall take as plunder for yourselves. And you shall enjoy the spoil of your enemies, which Yahweh your God has given you. Thus you shall do to all the cities that are very far from you, which are not cities of the nations here. But in the cities of these peoples that Yahweh your God is giving you for an inheritance, you shall save alive nothing that breathes. But you shall devote them to complete destruction. The Hittites and the Amorites, the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, as Yahweh your God has commanded, that they may not teach you to do according to all their abominable practices that they have done for their gods. And so you sin against Yahweh your God. When you besiege a city for a long time, making war against it in order to take it, you shall not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them. You may eat from them, but you shall not cut them down. Are the trees in the field human that they should be besieged by you? Only the trees that you know are not trees for food you may destroy and cut down, that you may build siege works against the city that makes war with you until it falls. So that's how you fight on Yahweh's side. Like I said, a couple of brief general comments. One from those last few verses, 19 and 20, there's a clear responsibility to steward the environment well. That's not, care of the world is not an idea that we came up with in the 1960s in the West. And the logic is pretty straightforward. This is going to be your home and your children's home and your grandchildren's home. The Bible does not teach that the end of history is all of us leaving earth and going somewhere else. The Bible teaches that the end of history is Jesus returning to earth and making an eternal home here with us. And so we want to treat the world we live in like we're going to be here forever, not exploit it for short-term gain at the cost of long-term flourishing. Okay. That's pretty straightforward. So that's one brief comment. The second, I am not going to go all the way into detail on this paragraph, verses 10 to 18. It sounds really harsh. We covered this in a fair bit of detail when we did Deuteronomy chapter 7 back in, I think, February. And Lord help us, that sermon is on the internet. So if you want to go and revisit it, you can. What I want to say is Moses makes a differentiation where the people are supposed to be more ruthless in the way they fight close to home. And the principle for us to draw out of that is that our zeal for battling evil in our own midst should be stronger than our zeal for battling evil out there in the world. That we should be more disturbed and more zealous in combating sin in the church than sin in Congress or sin in the school system or sin in our neighbors. First, take the log out of your own eye, Jesus says. If you find yourself very worked up about the state of society and praying, you would never say it this way, thank you, Lord, that we, the church, are not like them. That's not good. Right? Our prayer is, God, be merciful to us, sinners. Right? That's where our focus is first. Third brief comment. From out of the middle of this first paragraph, verses 1 to 9, this passage where they start sending people home. Right? And the principle is, if you haven't gotten to enjoy the blessings of home, don't fight this fight. It doesn't say, hey, give these folks who built a house and not dedicated or planted a vineyard and not tasted its fruit, you know, married a wife and not enjoyed that, give them the option. It says, send them home. Right? And the idea here is that even though there are always battles worth fighting, We are not to behave as if battle is all there is. We are not to live going from one war to the next, one campaign against sin and injustice to the next. We are also made to enjoy blessings. Right? It takes, I am not an expert, but it takes a while between planting a vineyard and actually enjoying the fruit. Right? There's a pretty good window there where that guy is just supposed to be home, enjoying the blessings of home, even though there are fights around him worth fighting. Right? So you, between the world, the flesh, and the devil, we are not running out of enemies until the end of history. But we're also not a military that is always at war. We also get to enjoy the life our good God has given us. So, three brief comments there. And then what I really has been impressed upon me and that I want us to focus on together is that when we fight, weakness is our friend and fear is our enemy. When we fight, weakness is our friend and fear is our enemy. The premise of the whole chapter is that the battles we will get into will be battles in which we are outmatched, where we do not have the strength to win. When you go out to war against your enemies and see horses and chariots and an army larger than your own, you shall not be afraid of them. God is taking it for granted that his people will be outnumbered and outgunned. Horses and chariots in the ancient Near East are the equivalent of like tanks and bombers now. They are the powerful offensive weapons of war, and God's people were not allowed to have them. They weren't supposed to have a military stockpile. They weren't supposed to be ready to win the next fight. They were supposed to be outnumbered and outgunned. We are supposed to be outnumbered and outgunned. And then, once we're outnumbered and outgunned, we are supposed to respond by doubling down on weakness. Right? It's at that point, all right, we have 1,000 with pistols, and they have 10,000 with machine guns and artillery. What do we do next? We send home all the young, strong men, right? What kind of men have just built a house but not gotten to dedicate it? Right? It's all young guys and Enrique. Right? Right? What kind of men have just gotten married or just planted a vineyard? Right? It's not the guys drawing Social Security. Right? During World War II and in subsequent wars, when the United States of America had a draft, right? All of the males at age 18 are supposed to register for the draft. Those are the two things that I got in the mail for my 18th birthday, a razor from Gillette, which you can see I've made very good use of, and an invitation to register for the draft, right? But after everybody registered for the draft, they were graded, right, on how fit they were for duty, right? And A1 meant you're good to go. You can serve in any branch of the military in any capacity, right? And this is the equivalent of if the U.S. had said, all right, we've got this huge war on our hands, let's grade everybody, and then let's tell all the A1s they're not allowed to fight. This is so backwards. So upside down from any way of fighting. Right? We're supposed to start off overmatched and then double down on weakness. When we fight, weakness is our friend. This is not how I like to do things. Right. And I know enough of you to say that generally it is not how we like to do things. Right. We like to figure out what we're good at and then do that. We like to figure out what we're bad at and then avoid that. God invites us, invite is too soft a word, God commands us to live differently. To live out of our weaknesses, to embrace the places that we are outnumbered and outgunned. and then see our weakness in those fights as our friend. This and how far the vision of this chapter is from our sort of automatic way of being in the world hit me hard Thursday morning, and I went for a walk around the block, and I came back to the office, and I started writing down in my Mernal. I was talking to Taylor or Rachel about this Friday night, and I was like, in my notebook that's really a journal, but I prefer to call it a notebook because I feel like that sounds more masculine. And then Rachel coined the term Mernal, you know, like a merce. So I was writing in my Mernal just like a line item list of all the places that I am outnumbered and outgunned. And it's a couple pages long. And I'll just give you a few. I am outnumbered and outgunned when it just comes to my own endemic sin. Lust, self-righteous anger, cowardice, my hero complex, my desire to be a part of the solution in every situation. I know what my enemies are, and I lose to them again and again and again. And that's by design in God's eyes. I am meant to be weak in the battle against my own sin. I am overmatched, outnumbered, and outgunned as a husband. I'm not confused about what it means for husbands to love their wives as Christ loves the church and gave himself up for her. I just can't pull it off. I know the rest of you husbands in the room do great at this, but I know exactly what I should be doing. I just consistently don't do it. I am outnumbered and outgunned as a father. When I think about my call as a father to help my children see by teaching them and by showing them that life is far better if they end up with nothing but Jesus than if they end up with everything but Jesus. I know what they need. And I can't get it across, right? Between the busy chaos of our schedule and the culture of succeed and achieve and do more and better that we swim in, I am not equal to the task. I'm outnumbered and outgunned, weak as a pastor, right? I know that I'm aware as I say that, this is not an area of weakness for me. I am good at preaching and speaking, right? And so I do a lot of displaying my strength as a pastor. But the things that, the kingdom of heaven being alive in our midst, right? Us living more like members of God's family than members of the city of Corvallis. Growing in intimacy with him, with one another, with our neighbors, figuring out ways to communally, joyfully, sacrificially give ourselves away in the name of doing justice. I cannot make those things happen. I know because I try and fail. And that's part of the design. Right? I'm meant to be weak. And then to double down on weakness. We're not supposed to be competent. We're not supposed to rely on our own strength. God intends you in every battle of your life that actually matters to be outnumbered and outgunned at the start and then to get weaker from there. I am going to give the opportunity for others to fill out our many weaknesses as a community. So if you are willing to name one of the places you are weak, I invite you to do so now.
Having control of life.
It feels like we're supposed to be in control, right? And we are not, spoiler alert. And that's on purpose. Right? That's like the American dream is be self-sufficient and prosperous. And we are not self-sufficient by design. Yeah, there's a good one. Like, we get praying for and with our children, right? Again, very clear what the task is. We just are weak. Yeah, Michelle. Yeah, Michelle said making wise decisions. I've lost track of the number of prayers I've started in the last year with, all right, God, you said in James, if anyone lacks wisdom, they should ask. I'm asking again. It seems like it would work, and then I wouldn't have to ask anymore. But no, he wants us to stay weak and in need of his wisdom. Ken said the problem is sometimes not a lack of wisdom, but a lack of obedience. There's a one of Andy Crouch's books names the two sort of core virtues in life as wisdom and courage, like knowing the right thing to do and having the courage to do it. Lack of grace. Yeah. If we could just love each other with a fraction of the grace and patience with which we are loved, we'd be a lot less weak. Contentment. Yeah. Being satisfied with what God provides. Yeah, as soon as I get the thing that I think will make me content, the next thing comes up. Yeah, what were you going
to
say, Dave?
Having courage to share Jesus.
Yeah, the elders and deacons gathered to pray this morning. Dave said having the courage to share Jesus with neighbors. The elders and deacons gathered to pray this morning, and somebody, we were praying about weakness and, you know, fear of feeling awkward. When talking about Jesus came up, and it was like everybody in the room looked around like, how did you know what was in my head when the first person said it? Our enemies outnumber and outgun us, right? Shame, fear, foolishness, selfishness, a culture that constantly pulls us towards busy self-importance. Right. Look around the room. I love you guys, but we don't stand a chance. Right. We are outnumbered and outgunned. And that is by design. In these battles, weakness is our friend. God made us to be weak and invites us to double down on weakness. Which is, it's not saying strength is a vice, right? Like, I'm not going to stop preaching and we're not going to do a survey to figure out who is most terrified of public speaking and have them step into the pulpit full time, right? But it means we don't avoid the battles where we are weak. We embrace them instead. Because as much as we know in these battles that weakness is our friend, we also know that fear is our enemy. I want to read again the last part of this paragraph. Right. So this is verses 8 and 9. And remember, the people started off outnumbered and outgunned. Now all the good soldiers have gone home. And then this. And the officers shall speak further to the people and say, is there any man who is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go back to his house, lest he make the heart of his fellows melt like his own. And when the officers have finished speaking to the people, then commanders shall be appointed at the head of the people. I want to spend a few minutes on the nuances here. Fear really is our enemy. The most common command in Scripture is do not fear. It will destroy us if we let it. But I also want you to notice the mercy and compassion in this. Verse 8 does not say, is there any man who is fearful and faint-hearted? You're kicked out of God's people. Right? We want nothing to do with you. Go away and never come back. That's not the message at all. The message is you have to deal with your fear first before you can join in the fight. Fear is your first enemy, and if it's ruling over you, then you're not ready to fight yet. Okay. I also notice really what sends you home is not feeling fear. I'm gonna go out on a limb and speculate that every single person there was feeling fearful and faint-hearted. Right? Some, it's like a lot of God's great warriors felt fear, right? I have lost track of the number of times in the Bible that Joshua, the general who leads the conquest of the promised land, gets told, be strong and courageous, right? That doesn't get said to naturally brave people. Right? There was nobody following George Patton around in Europe saying, George, remember to be strong and courageous. Right? He was on it. Right? Naturally cowardly people have to be told over and over again, be strong and courageous. Right? So feeling the fear did not disqualify Joshua. It didn't disqualify Gideon. Same thing. Right? Being ruled by your fear. Being unable to say no to your fear. That's what means you're not ready to fight yet. You haven't dealt with the first enemy. You're not yet ready to move on and join in the battle against other enemies. Right? Because fear is contagious. Right? This is true in literal wars. If a part of an army breaks and runs, almost every time, right, it's the start of a flood. The whole army will break and run. Right. So if you have a fear that is controlling, right, if the fear of being awkward or looking foolish controls whether or not you speak about Jesus, I mean, yeah, to your neighbors, but I'll say even like, other people who show up in church on a regular basis, right? Like you're not ready to join in the battle, right? If the fear of being left behind professionally controls your calendar and where you put attention, right? That has to be dealt with first before there's going to be any room in your life to fight any other battles. If the fear of upsetting someone and having them mad at you controls you, and you could never do that under any circumstances, that has to be dealt with first. Okay. Fear is the first enemy when it comes to the battles that matter. Not the feeling, right? But if fear can rule over us and determine what we are willing to do, what we are willing to say, where we are willing to go. Fear masquerades as a friend, right? Because some fears are your friend, right? Like, I'm afraid of poisonous snakes, right? And that fear has my back, right? I mean, but it wouldn't have my back if it was like, I cannot live anywhere where there are poisonous snakes, right? At that point, the fear that started as a friend has become the enemy, right? Because this is controlling my whole life, right? Your fear of the stove, that's your friend, right? But if you're like, I can't go in or work in or clean up in kitchens because the stove might burn me, now it's ruling over me, right? Fear is the first enemy, even when it's pretending to be your friend sometimes. Right? Like if you really have that, like, I'm terrified of upsetting other people, right? That the seed of that could be friendly. Right? It could be like, you know, like Paul says, if possible, to the degree it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. And that fear keeps you from just being mean. Right? But once it controls everything that you say, what started as your friend has become your enemy. Right. Fear is going to be a reasonable response in any battle where you are outnumbered and outgunned. Right. But controlling fear is not your friend. Right. We have battles to fight, and in those battles, weakness will be our friend. And fear will be our enemy. Because Yahweh is with us. Right. Him being with us, God joining in the battles, is what makes weakness our friend and what makes fear our enemy. When you go out to war against your enemies and see horses and chariots and an army larger than your own, you shall not be afraid of them. For Yahweh, your God, is with you, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And when you draw near to the battle, the priest shall come forward and speak to the people and shall say to them, Hear, O Israel, today you are drawing near for battle against your enemies. Let not your heart faint. Do not fear or panic or be in dread of them, for Yahweh your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to give you the victory. Very quickly, don't overhear this as any fight you decide to pick. Yahweh's got your back. The battles that he cares about, right? The ones that really are against the world or the flesh or the devil. In those, he is with you, and he's proven it, right? The text doesn't say, hey, just believe that God is with you, so who could be against you? It says, Yahweh your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, who already defeated the most powerful enemy around, Pharaoh, in front of your eyes. If he's with you, then your weakness is your friend, because it's just a reminder to trust his strength and not yours. And your fear is your enemy, because your fear is an invitation not to trust in his strength and to decide about the fight based on your weakness. If he's really with us, if he's shown his willingness to be with us in the fights that matter, then weakness is our friend and fear is our enemies. Now, you could say, that's great, but I wasn't delivered from Egypt. I didn't see the Red Sea split. I didn't see the angel of death and the plague of the firstborn or the Nile River turn into blood or any of that stuff. Right? Remember, we've been talking about this again and again in Deuteronomy, neither did the people listening to Moses. Their parents and grandparents saw it. They didn't. They were either babies or not born yet when all that stuff happened. The call to remember is not a call to examine your own personal history. It's a call to remember the whole history of God's people, where God has shown up and made his power perfect in their weakness again and again and again, where God has conquered on their behalf again and again and again, where God has given them again and again and again every reason to see weakness as their friend and fear as their enemy. As we sort of meander our way in the United States of America from a society where churches were strong, had an enormous amount of political and social and cultural clout, into a society where churches are growing weaker and weaker, where we have less clout than we used to, and looking down the road, that seems likely to continue. I think more and more about the early church. So for the first not quite 300 years after Jesus died and rose from the grave, the church was profoundly weak. Small in number, primarily made up of the poor and powerless, and alternating between being sort of contemptuously ignored by Rome and the other powers that be. Sometimes it was that, and sometimes being actively persecuted by Rome and the powers that be. And the whole time this was going on, the church grew through weakness. From a few thousand people in the years immediately after Jesus' life and death and resurrection, into, best guess, 10 million or so Christians in the Roman Empire, before the whole Emperor Constantine becomes a Christian and says it's okay to be a Christian, we will stop feeding you the lions, before there was any cultural or political reason to call yourself a Christian, the church steadily grew through weakness. It's remarkable. There were the first church building project that we know is dated more than 200 years after Jesus' life. Right? So it wasn't massive institution building. Right? As far as we know, there were no mission agencies or evangelism programs or parachurch ministries during any of this time. What there was were small communities of people who knew that Jesus was with them, and that weakness was their friend, and fear was their enemy. So they were willing to say no to their fears, that they wouldn't just feel awkward in talking to their neighbors about Jesus, but that they might get reported to the police and put on trial, and share him anyway. And they were willing to go into situations where they were weak. One of the things that Christians became known for in those early years was that when plague hit a city, and everybody who could fled, because they didn't understand everything we understand about disease, but they knew being near a sick person was a bad idea, Christians, instead of fleeing, would flock. Not because they were doctors, not because they had N95 masks and surgical gloves, but because Jesus, who had promised to be with them, came not for the healthy, but for the sick. And so they were willing to go into a situation where they were completely outnumbered and outgunned. They didn't even understand what the enemy was in terms of the disease, and serve exactly where they were weak. And it turned out that a lot of these plagues, the survival rate goes way up if you just have somebody making sure that you get food and water, right? That you're warm enough or cool enough. Right? And people would see Christians loving them and join the community. The church grew through its weakness. If Jesus really is with us. The Jesus who did not stay far removed, but embraced weakness by becoming a baby, by being stripped naked, by being hung on a cross. And didn't just embrace weakness for weakness' sake, but embrace weakness as the one and only way of conquering the enemies that really matter. If that Jesus is with us, then we have fights that are worth fighting. And in every single one of them, weakness is our friend, and fear is our enemy. Would that we would begin more and more to live accordingly. Let's pray. Jesus, you were clear about it. You came for the weak, for the needy, for the little children, for the lepers. And your weakness was stronger than our strength, and your foolishness was wiser than all the wisdom we could muster. And you won the only battle that ultimately matters through choosing to be weak. We believe that is true of you. Help our unbelief. We long to live as citizens of your kingdom, as your brothers and sisters in the family of heaven, but we lack the strength. You don't. Help us. Make us more and more willing to be weak, more and more willing to say no to our fears and hear you saying yes to us. Amen.